welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio, and I am your host, Webster Tarpley, speaking here from Washington, D.C. The Capitol is now gripped by the hysteria associated with the upcoming seizure of power by the Obama clique, the Obama banker's boy regime, headed by bailout Barkey himself. The president who in recent years, more than any other, as far as we can see so far, embodies the brutal dominance of Wall Street over the national government, although others have also done that with Obama. It's Wall Street domination, the banker's dictatorship, the rule of the finance oligarchs in very, very acute form. And therefore, we've got to address the policies of the coming administration and, above all, the question of economics. And first of all, we have to say welcome to the full fury of the Bush world economic and financial depression. I guess we can call it Bush. Maybe we should call it the Bush Alan Greenspan. We might call it the Bush Alan Greenspan Milton Friedman version of the world economic depression, because it is those policies of deregulation, privatization, union busting under Taft, Hartley, and generally the race to the bottom that have brought this on. The derivatives bubble growing out of deregulation. Derivatives should have been illegal. They were illegal from 1936 until 1982. They were made legal again under the auspices of free market fanatics, citing Milton Friedman and indeed the Austrian school for their disgusting crimes. And that's one. The other one, privatization. If you're concerned about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, those were government agencies that were privatized. It never should have been done. So chalk it up to deregulation, privatization. And now, of course, we've got the battle over whether we're going to have a low-wage economy. And the right-to-work states, the states that under the Taft-Hartley Act are allowed to prevent any union formation, they're taking the lead and saying, we want everybody dragged down to our level. So that's the race to the bottom. Union busting leads to the low-wage economy and the race to the bottom. And out of all that, you get a world economic depression of incalculable severity. Now, we've just gotten some truly chilling unemployment numbers today. We're recording on Friday, January 9th. We've just had epiphany this past week, and we've got an epiphany going in terms of the true dimensions of the depression. Foreclosures continue to mount. Unemployment is mounting. Alcoa says that they're going to shut down some of their plants and get rid of 10 to 15,000 of their employees. The list of layoffs, plant closures, and so forth is too long for me to go through right now. Suffice it to say, we are now in a violent contraction of production and employment, and we never had that much production in the United States. People say, oh, aren't we headed for socialism? Well, the problem with that is socialism would be government ownership of the means of production. The problem in the United States today is there are almost no means of production for anybody to be the owner of. So this is somewhat a moot point. The question is, we've got to build some means of production. And if the private sector is willing to build means of production, that's great. The problem is they haven't done it. So now we've got to turn to some form of government intervention to build means of production, which the private sector for the last 40 years not only has refused to build, they have asset-stripped the existing means of production, using them as a cash cow. That's the story of the American railroad. So we've got 40 years of failed policies. In reality, you can even say it's something like almost half a century of failed policies. Generally speaking, the turning point is the Kennedy assassination and the coming of the Vietnam War. The high point of the U.S. economy in terms of real wages probably reached about 1965, 1966, after which real wages have fallen. And by now, they've fallen by about two-thirds into this year. And every president along the way has done something. The ones that stand out, of course, Carter with the Volcker trilateral interest rate regime. Well, Volcker is now back in the government, thanks to Barkey Obama. bailout Barkey about to take power now on the 20th of January. Of course, he may have some stumbling blocks in his way, and we'll talk to one of the key people involved with that. We'll try to get Phil Berg on the line again for a weekly report if we can. But let's now look at, well, we'll try to do the practical questions of economic program and political activity, some attention to foreign policy also in the first hour. In the second hour, we've got to talk about economic schools. We've got to give you a lowdown, not just on Friedman, Chicago, von Hayek, von Mises, Austria, but also Malthus and Keynes, because they are also a threat. Right now, we're being caught in a kind of a pincers action run by finance oligarchs on both sides, between the Chicago School Friedmanite Austrian stuff on the one side and the green radical environmentalist Malthusian Keynesian version on the other. And the answer to that, of course, is the American system, the Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, Friedrich List, Henry Carey, Lincoln, Justin Morrill, Franklin D. Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy version. We can add some more names to the list, but you do get the idea. Let us now look at the speech that Obama gave yesterday as we're recording this about his own economic program. Now, this is Obama's economic stimulus plan. He's talking, well, Obama characteristically, as a political coward, is afraid to tell you how much he wants to spend because he knows he'll be attacked by right-wingers as soon as he says what he wants to spend. But it's thought to be $600 billion, $700 billion, $800 billion. And the question, of course, with something like this is, what are you going to spend it on? It simply will not do, by the way, to come on the scene like a free marketeer. Some of our anarcho-capitalists of the Chicago or Austrian persuasion who come on the scene and say, no, this should not be done. We should do nothing. We should have the full fury of the Depression. Let the Depression take its course. That is what von Hayek did all during the 1930s. He said any attempt to try to meddle with the Depression is illegitimate. We have to let the Depression have free play to destroy a generation of human beings and lay waste to entire countries. That was von Hayek's position. You can go back to his articles of the 1930s, and you'll see that that's what he was arguing. He was an unashamed apologist of the Great Depression. It had to happen, he said. It was unavoidable, and it was unavoidable to let it take its course. Well, no, I'm sorry. No, Friedrich von Hayek, you old Austrian titled aristocrat. The question now with the stimulus project is, what are you going to use it for? Now, we have suppose we now have a $700 billion stimulus. What should be done with that? Well, the first and most obvious thing is state budgets. Every state in the union virtually is going bankrupt. And this is the ones that have taxes, the ones that don't have taxes, and so on and so forth. Let's not try a lot. Some people now say, well, the ones that don't have state income taxes should be forced to have them before they get any federal money. No, no, no. We don't have time for all this stuff. We don't want to start playing one section of the United States against another. That would be a typical Ford Foundation oligarchical ploy. But the fact is, California, of course, is leading the pack under their failed governor, the liberal Republican Schwarzenegger, a clown from the Hippodrome. Always a bad idea when you get clowns from the Hippodrome. Al Franken, the most recent example. But Schwarzenegger is a complete failure. What has to happen? Let's take California. You've got to pipe about $50 billion in there on an emergency basis. Otherwise, you'll have no police, no fire department, no schools, no libraries, no public education, and no Medicaid. And that means people will die. So $50 billion for California. Right off the bat, similar amounts for the other states. We'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Crisis Radio, your host, Webster Topley, Washington, D.C. Let me take this opportunity to commend your attention to my books. At the present time, we have two in particular out on the market, Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. That is the lowdown on the Zbigniew Brzezinski Trilateral Control of Barkey. And then we have a more detailed, more lengthy study, which is the unauthorized biography of Barack H. Obama. Both of these are available at Amazon.com, and we will issue now within the next couple of months the long-awaited second edition of Surviving the Cataclysm, your guide through the worst economic and financial crisis in human history, which was originally finished at the end of 1998. First copies went out in the beginning of 1999, so 10 years ago. It is a snapshot from 10 years ago, a lot of the book is anyway, of an economy careening towards the kind of problems that we have today. In other words, a depression. It was only a question of time. The depression was programmed in. Once you had that deindustrialization going on, the attempt to have a post-industrial service economy, which is one of the main root causes of the present catastrophe, the lunacy, the absolutely insane idea that you could deindustrialize and have this country with a quarter million people or a third of a billion people go into a post-industrial service economy, in other words, a post-industrial pockmarked rubble field wasteland, and have a good economic result. Well, that was clear already 10 years ago. And on the other side, the growth of the toxic derivatives bubble, the derivatives being the other root cause of this. So you've got to deal with both of those. You've got to deal with deindustrialization and the prevalence of parasitical service economy stuff. And then you've got to deal with the derivatives by wiping them out, by deleting them, by shredding them. Too late for the bonfire of the derivatives, but we can soon have the, well, we'll find other seasonal variations on what to do with derivatives. The question now, of course, the stimulus program. Obama says he wants a large stimulus program, but he talks about it in terms which are very, very ominous. He says it's time to restore confidence. Wait a minute. It's time to restart production. Restart production. Forget about confidence. This is now in the realm of subjective lunacy, basically. Who knows what confidence means? Production is something we can quantify. We know what it is. So he talks about putting hundreds of billions of dollars into this green jobs stuff that he has, which is pure Malthusianism. And it always assumes that you're going to use some of the most backward anti-economical technologies you can. He wants green technology, which for him means solar panels, wind power. That's just wonderful. The great modern technology of the windmill, which has been around for how many thousands of years? And we're supposed to go back to a modern souped-up version of the windmill? This, again, Don Quixote tilting at windmills. That's our friend Barkey, kind of on the skinny side, too, just like Don Quixote in most of the versions you see. So the greening of America, this is simply a waste of money. But what this comes down to is a boondoggle for a bunch of parasitical entrepreneurs who can't sell this stuff competitively on a normal market, and therefore have got to get a government subsidy for it. Now, government subsidy is fine if the goal is something you really need, but why subsidize a backward technology when you could have a reconstruction program for the United States that would say, build 100 nuclear reactors right now on a crash basis, use emergency powers, use the Defense Production Act, roll over the Sierra Club, roll over the Canoe Federation, roll over the Wilderness Society, roll over the Friends of the Earth. Just stop them from tying everything up in court, and don't let them add billions of dollars to the cost. These rich elitists who have nothing to do but sit around and sue productive enterprises, get rid of them, build in protections against that. Otherwise, we're going to have many, many more millions of unemployed, and some of them are going to die. And we don't want to hear about the polar bears, the snail daughters, and the horned owls when human beings are dying. And that is the result. Again, if California goes under, California Medicaid will go under, That means that a quantifiable number of people will die. We're talking Nuremberg crimes now. This is Nuremberg. If you know that that's going to happen and you let it happen and you say, oh, well, the market made me do it. That's like saying going to Nuremberg and saying, oh, I'm following orders. The market made me do it, and my master is the market. No, no, no. As recent popes have also stressed, you can't get away with that one. There's no such thing as a determinism of the market. You have free will, and you better recognize your responsibility to use it. So a decent stimulus program, I would prefer to call it a recovery program because we're in a depression. A recovery program would be, first of all, convoy a lot of that money to the now bankrupt states and municipalities. I wonder what's going on in some place like East St. Louis, Illinois, some really poor towns out there in the burned-out industrial Midwest. I'm sure they're really hurting, right? The police department is collapsing. The fire department is collapsing. The library is closing down. The school system is already on a four-day week. We're getting proposals now that the whole country should go on a four-day week. The last time this was done was Ted Heath in Britain in the early 1970s when Britain was about to sink beneath the waters of the North Sea. So put a large amount, I would say $300 million, directly into the budgets of states and municipalities to save the fabric of civilization and prevent thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of needless deaths. Because if there's no police, no fire department, no local hospital, no Medicaid, then that means Americans will die. Is that what we're going to recommend, dear friends of the monetarist persuasions of all different kinds, dear apostles of Herbert Hoover today? Well, no, we cannot be associated with this. So we have this violent contraction. The other thing, of course, then would be to put it into infrastructure that the government will own. In other words, if it's federal spending, then the government should come out owning it. No Spanish multinationals, please, taking over the turnpikes and imposing tolls on Americans. And if those contracts exist, break them. Use the Defense Production Act. Use emergency powers to kick out the foreign bloodsuckers who have battened themselves on certain pieces of infrastructure and are using them for asset stripping and cash cow purposes. Now, obviously, in the middle of all this, you'd want to have the rebuilding of infrastructure is also a great idea. You simply cannot have water systems that are collapsing. We've had examples of that here, right, in suburban Maryland near Washington, D.C. We had one water main break in Montgomery County last June that cut off water to hundreds and thousands of homes. And we just had a huge water main break 2 days before Christmas that almost killed some people who were driving along River Road in the Washington suburbs. This is now century-old water systems that have got to be rebuilt. There's an area. No money for banks. Rebuild the water system so your kid can get a drink of water. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Crisis Radio, your host Webster Toffley here in Washington, D.C. So a few more comments on Obama's economic speech. The depression will get worse before it gets better. Yes, everybody can see that. On the other hand, that kind of argument won't last very long, Barkey, because with New Deal methods, you begin to get a turnaround very, very quickly. You begin to get amelioration in the key areas. So money that's going to be spent by the federal government. We got to build up this conceptual differentiation. Federal spending is one thing. Federal lending is a much bigger field. We should be doing more federal lending. But in terms of direct federal spending, if you're going to spend $600-700 billion, and people should get in there and fight for this, it's got to go to states, counties, and cities, municipalities, towns, to maintain the essential services of civilization. Please fire the rest of municipal, local government, Medicare, Medicaid, school systems, and so forth. And then you've got to think about your infrastructure program in terms of modernizing and rebuilding things that are about to collapse, because that is absolutely essential. You can't be riding over a bridge in Minnesota and have it go down. But then you've got to do something beyond that. You've got to do something to get out of a depression. You've got to do something to increase the productive power of labor, productivity of labor, always key. In order to do that, take the 25 largest U.S. metropolitan areas. Start building a high-speed, attractive mass transit system of the most modern type. Not green technology, modern technology. Forget green. The criterion is not what's green, what's not green, what's Malthusian, what does the Canoe Federation like, what do the boys over at Friends of the Earth like. Forget them. No green, just modern, the most modern. It's probably maglev. You might have a maglev system if you have a large metropolitan area like Los Angeles or Chicago. Get a maglev, magnetic levitation, magnetic cushion train that can whisk you downtown in just a few minutes. So do that, let's say, for the 25 largest metropolitan areas. Now, that would help the urban and suburban populations. How about rural America? Are we going to let them wither on the vine? No, we are not. Let's build a new transcontinental railroad of the most modern type. It's probably the German Transrapid Maglev variation, although the Japanese will also compete, so you'll be able to get the best of both. Build that from Boston to New York to Chicago to Kansas City out to Los Angeles, and then have two spurs, right? One goes up to Seattle, the other one goes down to San Diego. You've covered San Francisco and all the rest. And then have another line, right? You go back and look at your basic transcontinental railroad map. You have a southern version of the same thing, and then you have a northern version that covers Minneapolis and the Dakotas and what have you. All maglev. Start that immediately. That will be a permanent value. In other words, you will have acquired a valuable, valuable infrastructure improvement that will last for hundreds of years if you build it right and you want to build it right, and you will be getting yourself out of a depression. The only way you can maintain a high standard of living in the United States is to go back to high levels of science and technology incorporated into everyday economic activity. Otherwise, you cannot compete with some poor wretch in Thailand or whatever who's getting 50 cents a day. The only way you can do that is by moving the entire U.S. economy to the highest possible level of science and technology. Barkey's plan does the opposite. Barkey says we have to have green. We have to have all, you know, we're going to have federal green buildings. Yeah, it's nice to save a few bucks on heating your federal building. Yeah. That's all fine. But this is nothing. This is, it's not even worth mentioning in the context of a world economic depression of this type. So that's your stimulus issue. But you've also got the problem then of the TARP, and this is now becoming acute, because the Troubled Asset Relief Program, run by our dear friend, Comrade Kash Kari of Goldman Sachs, the appointee of Comrade Paulson over at Goldman Sachs, the first $350 billion of the TARP that was approved, big mistake, back in September, October, has been put out to the banks. They have used this money to buy preferred stock in what amount to bankrupt institutions, insolvent institutions, that is to say J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, Bank of New York Mellon, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, you know the rest. It has facilitated also the eating up, the phagocytation of Merrill Lynch by Bank of America, of Washington Mutual by J.P. Morgan, and on and on. So the question now is, after the first $350 billion has been wasted, what do you do with the second $350 billion? Let's just point out, the first $350 billion, we were told, was not a bailout for Wall Street. Oh, no. It's a bailout for Main Street. And what's going to happen is when you put $350 billion into Wall Street, that will unclog the credit system, commercial lending will restart again, and the credit system will work again. But wait a minute. If that were true, why did General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler have to come forward and say they were on the brink of going bankrupt? It's clear that these New York money center banks and the Bank of America thrown in, the big money center banks, I guess we call them, Wall Street generically, they're not lending. They never did lend. We've stressed this repeatedly on this program. Those banks have not been lending to productive activity for decades. Those are monsters of speculation. Those are entities that speculate against the American people. The reason the gas price got up to $4.50 a gallon in July was because of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley speculating in those markets, and then a school of hedge fund sharks that followed them. Now that a lot of those hedge funds are bankrupt and unwound, the price has come down again. Also, other factors have kicked in connected to the depression. But the thing that really broke the back of the high gasoline price was the fact that Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were on the verge of bankruptcy and had to sell everything in sight, including these speculative oil futures. So essentially, we're subsidizing J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, so they can stay around and speculate against the American people and parasitize the real economy. But they don't lend. They don't lend to Detroit. They don't lend to the local restaurant or the auto repair guy or the dry cleaner. They don't lend to productive activity. So the whole point of this is the first round of the TARP, as we knew, is a failure because it's a bailout of Wall Street, and Wall Street is hopelessly bankrupt. J.P. Morgan Chase now. Watch the price of J.P. Morgan Chase stock. It is going down. It's in the upper 20s now, and I suspect it's going to be next, right? We had Citibank blow out and get a second-round bailout on the Swiss model after this first the first TARP was done on the British model of Gordon Brown. Citibank basically went bankrupt a second time under the auspices of the TARP. Now you're going to see J.P. Morgan Chase be the next one to go bankrupt under the auspices of the TARP. And they never made any loans to General Motors or Chrysler. In other words, it's not like they're saying, guys, credit is now a public utility and we're going to use it for the public good. No, no, not Jamie Dimon. Those people need to go to jail. These are basically Madoffs of a bigger caliber who operate from banks rather than from this Park Avenue operation that Madoff had going. So the big thing is the first round of the TARP was a failure. They didn't lend to industrial corporations and Main Street who needed it. Therefore, if we're going to have a second round of the TARP, and it's already been approved, it's already been authorized, but it hasn't been appropriated, right? Everything in Congress has to happen twice. What we would need to do is make the transition away from the bailout of Wall Street towards real economics. In other words, here we're dealing with $350 billion, which could be the leading edge of federal lending. And this could be done as part of a dirigistic program to force this money to be lent into productive areas to actually restart economic activity. We'll talk about it in a minute here on World Crisis Radio. Radio, your host Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. Just in terms of that unemployment report, it is one of the grimmest in many, many decades. We now have an official unemployment rate of 7.2%. Now, of course, you know the way the system works. If you give up in despair and don't keep somehow contacting the state unemployment authorities, you disappear. So this 7.2% certainly means a 15% unemployment rate, and it may be as much as 20%, because we just don't know how many people have simply disappeared from the system. And generally speaking, reactionary Republicans and Malthusian Democrats don't want to know, because that would build public pressure to do something for production and employment rather than for the ideological fetishes of the polar bears on one side and the market on the other. Those are the two crossbars of the cross where they propose to crucify the American people. So 7.2% officially, the highest in 16 years. Now, 525,000 jobs disappeared in December. November was about 500,000 jobs. So you've lost a million jobs in 2 months. And the economy in 2008, minus 2.6 million jobs. Bush's goodbye kiss. Minus 2.6 million jobs. A reactionary Republican administration that always talked about free markets, that deregulated and privatized as much as they could. Tried to privatize Social Security. Remember that one? Luckily, they failed. If not, it would mean more deaths, more needless deaths among the American people, and Medicare in particular. Boy, the amount of mortality among old people that would come about if you got rid of that would be chilling. It would be, again, on the Nuremberg scale. So 2008, minus 2.6 million jobs, and apparently that's the worst since 1945. That is to say, since demobilization after World War II. Now, demobilization was botched because it was done by Harry S. Truman, banker's boy, puppet of Wall Street, run by Clark Clifford on the domestic front for the Harrimans and run by Dean Acheson and Abel Harriman directly in the international area. That's why Truman was such a puppet, a contemptible oligarch boy in the presidency. So he botched the demobilization. So we've got the worst job picture since 1945, since the demobilization. We've just had it in 2008. Everybody agrees that unless something is done, 2009 will be worse. And of course, do you think that something ought to be done? Are you a quietist? I mean, do you think it's fate? And then somebody should do it. And who's going to do it? Well, if you're an individual, you can't start giving orders to some company. But your government is subjected to your will if you're willing to get out and express it. So rather than sitting around saying you don't like big government and you want the government out of your life, get yourself into the government, at least get yourself into the position of influencing the government. Now, the second $350 billion, the second tranche of the TARP, what could be done with this? Some people say, well, nothing should be done. They shouldn't have it. Well, I think something could be done with this. Again, that's $350 billion that these clowns are talking about spending. Let's think about spending it. We've already taken care of states and cities, I believe, with the recovery program, the stimulus, so-called. And we've now got to think about long-term stuff. Again, let's put that into auto reconversion. Let's put that into converting General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler so that instead of just producing these motor cars, which will not be enough, the market for those will simply not be enough in the years and decades to come, let's think about tractors. Let's think about nuclear plants. Let's think about airframes for space exploration and colonization in the framework of a federally sponsored NASA program of the kind that worked so well in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s even. Let's think about other things, in particular rolling stock, locomotives, and cars for mass transit around all of the cities. Let's think about making investments in plants and equipment, capital goods, machine tools. You've heard it. Machine tools. The heart of any economy is not the banking system. It's the machine tool industry. And the U.S. one is on life support, if it exists at all. So get some federal money going into machine tools. Now, just to remember, the lending criteria. We've got Larry Flint and the pornographers come forward and say, we want a bailout. Well, the answer is no. No bailouts for non-productive activities. I'm afraid Larry Flint and his pornography associates are in the same category with Wall Street. In other words, financial services are not productive. Pornography is not productive. Prostitution, not productive. Narcotics, not productive. A whole area of economic activity is not productive, to put it mildly, and actually parasitical and damaging to human society. So people who are determined to engage in financial services, pornography, prostitution, and narcotics should take their chances out there in that free market that they claim to admire so much. They should not be given a penny of federal money. And this, of course, is the great problem. You cannot bail out derivatives. You shouldn't even try. 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives is too much. But this principle also extends to other areas, right? There is no future in these things that Larry Flynt represents. So this is a way to begin to understand the absolutely fundamental criterion. If you're willing to invest in plant and equipment and jobs in any productive area, and indeed in any socially necessary area. Let's talk about that for a second. There are other things like schools, health systems, most dramatic example, which are not in themselves productive, but which are indispensable for people who are going to be then in production. But the way you have to look at it is your productive workforce will tell you what kind of healthcare system you need at a certain level. In other words, you won't be able to support the healthcare if you don't have a productive workforce going. So you've got to think about the needs of a productive workforce, and that will dictate a very, very high level, much increased level of healthcare in future times. So these criteria could then be used to say, let's take the $350 billion, the second tranche of the TARP, and let's deny that to Wall Street. Not one penny for J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs. Not one penny. They've tried it. They take the money, they sit on it, and if they get a second wind, they'll start speculating again and the gas price will go up. And they'll buy more derivatives to add to their 1.5 quadrillion that they've got already. Now, we have this interesting case, Barney Frank, and he comes out, Barney Frank, obviously we won't make all the jokes about Barney Frank that we could make. He wants to have a conditionalities bill attached to the second part of the TARP. He's concerned about the fact that that nothing has been done about foreclosures. It's a good point. The answer to foreclosures is to stop them. Federal law, ban foreclosures. No foreclosures. At this point now, after the owners of the foreclosures, of course, are J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank and Bank of America and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. They're the ones who have the mortgage-backed securities. So you're going to let them take $350 billion of the first TARP, and then they're going to turn around and say, thank you for letting me survive. Now I'm foreclosing on you. The only way to restore equity, the only way to protect the taxpayer interest is to do what I proposed to do back in September, October of 2007 already, almost a year and a half ago now, stop all foreclosures, and not just on homes, but on farms, on businesses, on infrastructure, right? The classic trucking company, taxi company, ferry, airline, railroad, any factory that produces anything, a dry cleaner, a restaurant, anything, an auto repair shop, no foreclosures, no foreclosures. Human civilization comes first. We can worry about the debt later on. Better yet, we can have a debt moratorium and get to it much, much later once the recovery has begun. We'll be back in a minute here on World Crisis Radio. Crisis Radio, our second hour here from Washington, D.C., Webster Tarpley reporting. So we're looking above all at the Depression. We've now had the worst job loss since 1945. Real unemployment, I would estimate now between 15 and 20%, headed towards 30 to 35% minimum. And we're going to have to reindustrialize the United States, because once we get the dollar panic within a year or two, we're going to have nothing here to work with. Remember, the original Great Depression was detonated to some degree by the October 1929 banking crisis in the United States. But that's not the main event. That's just one factor. After the October 1929 crash, you then get the U.S. financial supports to the banks of Central Europe, the Austrian and German banks, the Danat Bank and the Kreditanstalt of Austria. Those blow out. And then it goes into Holland. It jumps across the channel, basically, to the heart of the 1920s, 1930s international financial system, which is the British pound. And the absolutely central event of the World Economic Depression the other time around is September 1931. The British pound defaults on gold payment. The end of the world, as many bankers put it at that time. So we are now between October 1929, you can say that's the equivalent of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, AIG, Citibank, all these things blowing up last year, and the banks that went, IndyMac, of course, and the others, and Northern Rock in 2007, and indeed back to Countrywide. You've had that kind of an event that kicks off the Depression. We're now in a contraction. This is similar to 1930, let's say, and you're headed towards a currency crisis, that is to say a world monetary crisis, which is going to have something to do with the collapse of the dollar. If we look back, the pound blew up, the British pound blew September 1931. Go and look at this. There's an essay about this on my website, tarpley.net. There's, a pretty useful essay about how British financial warfare was instrumental in bringing on the Great Depression of the 1930s. But the pound, September 1931, that blew up the only monetary system the world had. And if you now get a dollar crisis, which you're going to get sooner or later, especially with this hyperinflationary stuff being done by Bernanke and by bailout Barkey, then there's going to be some kind of a dollar crisis. And at that point, you will not be able to import many of the things you need, because people will not take these green pieces of paper. And they'll say, pay in gold or sell something on the market to earn foreign exchange, to earn the money for the things you need. The dollar system will come crashing down. At that point, you better have some industrial production. You better have some agricultural production. You better have some urban mass transit, because you got to get people to work. And if you're sitting there with prostitution, pornography, financial services, and narcotics, then that is a recipe for mortality, for morbidity and mortality on a very large scale. So what we're proposing now with the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and every time I say this, it feels like a personal insult that they designed this as a jibe at me, but with the TARP, let's go from where we are now to something more successful. Where we are now is essentially the Herbert Hoover Reconstruction Finance Corporation of 1932 and 1933. Remember, $3 billion, about the size of the whole federal budget then, was put into the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and it made loans to try to prop up banks. They tried to save banks. They did exactly what is being done now. It was a colossal failure. You cannot prop up banks. You cannot prop up speculative, bloated, cancerous paper values. You can't keep the stock market up. You can't do anything in terms of the price of derivatives or the price of any kind of paper. Forget that. You cannot prop up these banks. They're bankrupt. They've got to go into Chapter 11, and for a lot of them, that's going to turn into Chapter 7, liquidation for J.P. Morgan and Citibank and Bank of America, and good riddance, because, again, for decades, they have not been lending to anything productive. They've basically been speculating and trading on their own account. So you've got to get out of the failed Herbert Hoover phase of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Remember that Herbert Hoover refused to make payments to individuals. He wouldn't do anything to stop foreclosures, just like today. It's uncanny, the parallels that are going on between Herbert Hoover and the current, let's call it the Bush-Barkey transition tandem, because they seem to agree. Remember, I call him Bailout Barkey because he was the one who organized the Democrats, in particular the Black Caucus, to vote for this TARP bailout. So we've got to dump the failed policies of Herbert Hoover. Up to now, we've had Herbert Hoover. Don't listen to Time magazine or these other people who tell you that Obama is Franklin D. Roosevelt. He's not. He is Herbert Hoover. And with Geithner and Volcker and Summers, he will continue to be Herbert Hoover. Franklin D. Roosevelt, we're still looking for, but it's not Bush. Bush is more like Andrew Mellon. And Barkey is more like Herbert Hoover, and we're still looking for a Franklin D. Roosevelt figure to come forward. We don't have it so far. That's the problem. But what we've got to do with the TARP specifically is to go from the failed Herbert Hoover Reconstruction Finance Corporation that tried to prop up banks, and they were all swept away in the spring of 1933. They all closed down. Not one of them would have survived without the Roosevelt bank holiday. We've got to go to the Jesse Jones Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Now, this is a completely different thing. The name is the same. The money is much greater. Instead of $3 billion, we now get up to $50 billion ultimately. And what does Jesse Jones do? He builds factories. He builds plant and equipment. He builds infrastructure, tangible, physical wealth. Things that you can use, and there's no doubt about what they're worth. If you can get to work in 10 minutes, that has a definite economic value. If you're helping farmers, if you're putting in rail lines and rebuilding infrastructure and rebuilding industry with the Jesse Jones Reconstruction Finance Corporation, that's what you want to do with this TARP. Obviously, then you want to take that and generalize it to the point where the federalized, nationalized, seized Federal Reserve is taking orders from Congress, the President, and an aroused public, and on lending credit at 1% or less for productive activity only. Productive activity only, not narcotics, not any of that other stuff, not financial services, not derivatives. Jesse Jones, if you look at the state of Texas, let's say, we've talked about California, now let's go on to Texas, they would have to say that Jesse Jones built modern Texas with money from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, above all, the entire war plant system of Houston and Galveston and the Texas coast and the Louisiana coast. All those shipyards, some of them have disappeared in the meantime under Friedmanite monetarist auspices, but everything that was there to modernize Texas, basically to pull Texas out of the post-Civil War slump, because that's what it was, unfortunately, was due to Jesse Jones of Texas and the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. This is a great American who deserves to be remembered. Jesse Jones, Reconstruction Finance Corporation, in the successful phase, when you were not worrying about bankers or paper values, you were worrying about providing real, tangible, physical wealth for the American people that would stay, that would not, you know, disappear if a market crashed the next day. So that's, I think, absolutely fundamental. Now, we have to get through some lies. If we listen to Limbaugh, oh, Rush Limbaugh is celebrating his 20th anniversary on the radio. He's coming up with a big lie. Franklin D. Roosevelt prolonged the Depression. Oh, my God, what a lie. What a lie. Four presidential elections with landslide majorities say different, Rush. Herbert Hoover was the guy who prolonged the Depression. Let's give guilt where it's due. The World Economic Depression of the 1930s on the American side, created by Andrew Mellon, who ran Harding and Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover's problem was that he didn't do anything to stop it. Roosevelt stopped it. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Here in Washington, D.C. Now, we're honored once again to be joined by Philip J. Berg, Esquire, former Assistant Attorney General of the state of Pennsylvania, former Democratic Party official, former candidate for governor of Pennsylvania, senator from Pennsylvania on the Democratic Party primaries. And since August, Phil has been leading the fight to investigate, to expose the question of whether Barack H. Obama, also known as Barry Sotero, is indeed qualified for the presidency in the sense of being a natural-born citizen of the United States, which is what the Constitution demands. And if you're, you know, complaining about Bush not following the Constitution, it's probably time to get back to it. And we know that today, we're recording here on Friday the 9th. Yesterday, the electoral votes were counted in the House, and Obama is now officially the president-elect, something he was not until yesterday, because until yesterday, the federal government officially did not know who had won the Electoral College, meaning the election and the presidency. So now we have a president-elect, and the big question today was going to be the judicial conference over at the Supreme Court. So we're happy to welcome Phil and see if he has any updates on that. Welcome,
Phil.
How you doing?
My pleasure to be on. Number one, when the official count that was taken yesterday with the joint session of Congress for the count of Electoral College vote, it was done improperly. Actually, what's supposed to happen is as each state is called and the vote is recorded, thereafter the head of the Senate, which would be Vice President Cheney, he's supposed to ask, are there any objections? He's supposed to do that, we believe, after each state, if not before they're tallied, and he did not do it at all. It's a technicality, but we might have to use it in the future, but we'll see. But more important is what you said. The U.S. Supreme Court is conferencing my case today, and that's the case of Berg versus Obama, which I originally filed in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And we're very hopeful that the court will decide to hear our case.
Yes, and I'm wondering, Phil, it occurred to me a little bit too late concerning this Electoral College count. People who saw something like, you know, Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 or whatever that stuff was, saw the interesting films that were made of the question of the counting of these votes. Remember last time around, Boxer, Senator Boxer of California, actually did make an objection to Bush winning the presidency again in 2004. And I'm wondering, was there not any Republican who was willing to stand up and say, we want to see the birth certificate, just raise the issue of the birth certificate or citizenship or something along these lines in the middle of that joint session of Congress, which is, I think, what it was?
Well, they couldn't have said that. They would have just had us take an objection and maybe state the reason for it, but it wasn't done. The reports, I didn't see it, but I understand that.
Because you remember, right, when Boxer said, I object, yeah. They then had to go, they had to divide, right? The House and the Senate divided again, and they both then went back and voted about was the objection, and they debated the objection briefly, and then, of course, rolled over it. But that would have been a chance. So I guess we have to conclude that our heroes of the Republican Party are not willing to do anything for the Constitution by saying, wait a minute, where's your birth certificate? Where were you born? And are you still a citizen?
That's correct. It's very unfortunate. So today, on my case, there's two conferences scheduled, one for today, which is the 9th of January, and there's another conference scheduled in my case, which is next week, which is the 16th. So we can only hope that the Supreme Court really wants to take a look at the U.S. Constitution. We really have to enforce the Constitution. I know that thousands and thousands of letters were written in by people all across this great nation asking the Supreme Court to look at this case. So it's really important that they do it, but, you know, the Supreme Court does what they want to do. But regardless of whatever transpires, now we're hoping the Supreme Court will take the case. If they don't take the case, you have my pledge and assurance here that I'm continuing my efforts. Currently, I have two other litigation going on. I have a lawsuit, which we just filed about a week ago, with a retired Air Force Colonel, Gregory Hollister. We filed that against Barry Sotero, a.k.a. Barack Hussein Obama. The because we don't believe he ever legally changed his name after being adopted in Indonesia. But that case is an interpleader action which shifts the burden to Obama to establish who he is. Also, we have another case which was filed 2 months ago, but the case is under seal, so I cannot discuss it. If nothing else works between now and January 20th, then once he is sworn into office, we will be filing an action called a quo warranto, which questions whether the person is rightfully in the office. And we're not going to give up on this until there's some resolution one way or the other. Like, if he can prove that I'm incorrect, show us the records. Show us your bulk copy of your birth certificate from Hawaii, number one. And number two, show us the records that you received, your certificate of citizenship, when you came back through immigration from the state, with the State Department, from Indonesia. But those records, if he went through immigration, would only indicate that he's a naturalized citizen. So I believe he has them. That's why he hasn't shown them. Or we really believe he didn't go through immigration on the way back, and therefore, as we discussed before, believe it or not, he would be an illegal alien and not only not be able to be president, but the past 3 years as a United States senator would be a fraudulent action, and he would have to be held accountable for that. There's one other issue out there, and that's at age 20, he traveled to Pakistan on an Indonesia passport. If he was a U.S. citizen at that time, he would have done an overt act against the United States, which would have affected his citizenship, because United States citizens were prohibited from going to Pakistan in 1981. So if he had a U.S. passport and then went to get an Indonesia passport, he would have been doing an overt act against. But what we think really happened is that he's never really been a United States citizen after being in Indonesia, and that he has been using his passport from Indonesia up until he became a United States senator, at which time he's probably been using a diplomatic passport. So there's a lot of unanswered questions here. So we are hopeful that the Supreme Court, the only thing they have to do is issue a temporary injunction. They can either take my case or just issue an injunction and demand during that time that Obama produce the documents, which I just mentioned, along with any official change of name documentation. Otherwise,
produce the documents. So in terms of what's going on today, how and when are we likely to find out what, if any, result there is today?
Well, usually you have to wait till Monday. Sometimes they release on a Friday. It's up to the Supreme Court. They do what they want to do.
Hang on. We'll be right back.
Is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
Crisis Radio, Webster Toffoli here in Washington, talking to attorney Phil Berg in Philadelphia. Phil Berg, of course, the protagonist of legal actions to clarify the issue of Obama's disqualification to be president based on the fact that he was, according to the evidence we have, born in Kenya and a citizen right now of Indonesia, and Obama is not even his real name. I'm sure, Phil, that we can look to your website, ObamaCrimes.com, for an early update on what, if anything, comes out of the Supreme Court today. But let me also pay tribute to you. I have my copy of the Globe here, right? Supermarket tabloid. And on the front page of the Globe, we see this is going to be on sale, I think, through January 12th, meaning through the weekend. You can go to your supermarket and get the Globe. Don't get the New York Times. Don't get the Washington Post or the Los Angeles Times, all those rags. Get the Globe. And the headline, Where Obama Was Really Born, big picture of Barkey. In this hospital, 8,000 miles from the U.S., new shocking charge. Is his inauguration against the law? and we turn into the centerfold of the issue. Shocking charge, Obama presidency illegal. He was born in this foreign hospital, that is to say, the Coast Province General Hospital maternity wing in Mombasa, Kenya, down in the southern tip of Kenya, obviously then not qualified. And here we see, meanwhile, a lawsuit filed by Philip J. Berg, former Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania, claims there is evidence Obama was born in Kenya. His suit was rejected by a federal judge, and then talks about the appeal and so forth. So congratulations to you for keeping this in the public eye. And the fact that this is the headline story of the Globe means that whatever these courts do, the political reality, I think, is coming home to people. You have an illegitimate president, a usurper. Okay, well, I want to let's just read the next paragraph. Berg's appeal for an injunction to halt the electoral count and throw out the results of the election was also denied by the U.S. Supreme Court. But Berg is still pressing his case in court. As part of the lawsuit, Berg has submitted an affidavit from noted African evangelist, the Reverend Kwesi Shuhubia, claiming that it's common knowledge in Kenya that the Democrat from Illinois was born in Mombasa. So tribute to you, Phil. I just went through the details of this big cover story of the Globe, where Obama was really born. Get it in your supermarkets. There's also something else people can do. If people really have low energy levels, there's a referendum in here. Cast your vote, truth or vicious smear. If you're convinced that Obama is not a natural-born citizen, send an email to nocitizenobama, nocitizenobama, all one word, at GlobeFL, that is Globe Florida, GlobeFL.com, nocitizenobama at GlobeFL.com, and they will compile our votes and publish them in a future issue of the Globe. So if that's all you can do, do that. But I think it's also good still to send letters. Am I right?
That's correct. That's correct. And have you mentioned my website?
I mentioned ObamaCrimes.com is where we'll probably find out most easily what, if anything, is decided in the Supreme Court today.
Correct. And on there, there's information how to send letters, to continue to send letters to the U.S. Supreme Court. Also, we have a request on there for some contributions if people will do it, because this is going on longer than we thought. We're now filing more actions, and we're going to keep up on this. We're determined for the 305 million people in this country to find out the true answer. And we believe we know the answer. If we're wrong, that doesn't produce the documentation. And I'm sure we're right, and we're going to pursue this until the truth comes out, because we're in grave danger in this country. We're headed towards a constitutional crisis. And matter of fact, and I think he's open, Webster, for blackmail. And I've really been thinking about it, and I think he's being blackmailed already. I'll tell you why. He's a candidate of change. Look at his cabinet. His cabinet is 70% from Bill Clinton. But more important than that, look at who his Secretary of Defense is. Leftover from Bush.
Leftover from Brzezinski, I would say. A Brzezinski retread from the Carter National Security Council, Robert Gates. Somebody who was involved in Iran-Contra, who was involved in the October surprise, and who was part of the operation to take the hostages in Iran in the first place, as a cover for military deliveries to Iran demanded by Brzezinski. So not a good thing.
Okay, but think about it now. He's the candidate of change. And look at who his cabinet is. Look at who the Secretary of Defense. I think the powers that be in this country have pulled him aside and said, listen, we know that Berg is right. And if you want to be, until someone else gets you out of there, if you want to be president, you're going to have to play ball with us. What's your thoughts on that, Webster?
Well, I think that's, you know, they've had multiple systems built in. It's not just even one control system. We have today the news that Blagojevich has been impeached by the lower house of the Illinois state legislature. And I'm just hoping, maybe you can give a legal opinion, if they're going to have a trial in the Illinois State Senate, which I guess is the procedure, then there have got to be witnesses, and Obama and Axelrod and Valerie Jarrett and Rahm Emanuel and Michelle have all got to be called. They've got to be put under oath, and they've got to be questioned about this matter of buying and selling Senate seats and the other pay-to-play combine stuff. But then the first question you'd have to ask Obama under oath is, where were you born? And
absolutely.
Are you an American citizen?
Absolutely. That would be wonderful. And I don't think the House is rushing to judgment on there. I don't think they have enough evidence. I don't think the Senate will convict them. At least that's according to what he says himself here. I think they jumped too fast on this last thing, and I'm not sure why, maybe to protect somebody else. But they did, on this last charge of trying to sell the Senate seat of Obama, they don't have enough information. They don't have enough for a felony. They might have enough for a misdemeanor, unless he has other stuff over the other years, but I'm not sure. But time will tell. But my concern, though, is that we want a peaceful revolution to enforce our U.S. Constitution. We're praying right now that the U.S. Supreme Court decides to take this case so that the American people can really understand who the next president will be or won't be based on the fact, is he natural born, or is this, as I believe, the biggest hoax ever contemplated against the United States in over 230 years?
Absolutely. I mean, it's putting a basically unknown person in the White House and with all the unbelievable complications. So the one thing I would point out is with Harry Truman, Harry Truman was, of course, a puppet of the Harriman banking interests. But the way they controlled him was that he came out of a dirty machine, the Pendergast machine of Kansas City, Missouri. Boss Pendergast had been indicted and thrown in jail. Anytime Harry Truman acted up, anytime he showed a desire not to follow the orders from his handlers and the White House Palace Guard and the Wall Street people, they could always remind them, you know, Harry, you know, Pendergast was in jail for a couple of years and you could go there too. I think the goal with this whole Blagojevich business is to somehow make that point for Obama, but then to keep it contained. In other words, they don't want to bring down Obama now. They just want to have him controlled so they can say, look, Barkey, we can get you on the Resco business. We can get you on Ouchie. We can get you on Al-Samari. We can get you on Blagojevich. We can get you on Daley. We can get you on your citizenship, your non-qualification for the office, and therefore you follow orders. And I think it's that. But now Blagojevich seems to have more fight in him than the average politician, and I think that's in some ways very interesting.
Yeah, and I think his appointment of Burris was beautiful.
Right. That's obviously a step towards this. So let me thank Phil Berg again. You can read all about Phil Berg in The Globe. He's basically the cover story, the front page story in The Globe in every supermarket checkout aisle. This is something that sells incomparably more than these discredited rags like the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the New York Times. And Phil Berg is all over that article, Obama Presidency Illegal. Congratulations, Phil, and we hope to have you back next week with some good news.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Let me repeat, this issue of The Globe is really an interesting one. The supermarket tabloid, The Globe, where Obama was really born, in Mombasa, Kenya. Now, if you go to the supermarkets and other bookshops and so forth, you're going to see all of this trashy memorabilia, right? Obama inaugural keepsake collectible, collector's edition and all that stuff. That's not what you want. You want to get yourself a copy of The Globe, where Obama was really born. That's something you're going to want to show to your grandchildren and others in years and decades to come, that you were part of the fight, because this is not going to be kept secret. It's too big to be kept secret. Every secret intelligence agency in the world knows this, and it's very likely that it's going to come to the public view at some point during the crises of the catastrophic trilateral Obama administration. So buy up the copies of The Globe. Those are your real collector's items for the inauguration. And again, go to obamacrimes.com. Give Phil Berg a contribution, whatever you can afford. There are all sorts of ways to do it. You can send it in a nice anonymous envelope if you're if that's your preference. And you'll also find there the update on what the Supreme Court has or has not done today. That is today, Friday, January 9th. And another similar conference coming up a week from today on January 16th. So you need to check into Berg's website every day to see what's going on. You'll find there the instructions on how to mail letters, right? For, you know, as he says, in less than half an hour for two bucks or so, you can get on the scoreboard vis-a-vis the Supreme Court. Don't sit around and complain about Obama in the future. If Obama leaves you nothing but your eyes to cry with, don't complain unless you have sent in those letters to the various people, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Scalia, Breyer, and Stevens and Ginsburg, and did I get them all? I think I did. You need 7 to 8 copies. You want to send one to Berg also. It's all done with a simple stamp, first-class mail. And then have some fun over the weekend. The Globe, no citizen Obama. Send an email saying, no way, Jose, no citizen Obama. NOCITIZENOBAMA, all one word. No citizen Obama at GlobeFL. GlobeFL is all one word. GlobeFL. F as in Frank, L as in Louise. GlobeFL.com. So no citizen Obama at GlobeFL.com. Get on the scoreboard. Tell them that you don't think Obama is qualified for the presidency. Now, we would have a lot to talk about in terms of economics. Let's talk about the two schools once again. We'll talk more about the Austrian school next time and the Chicago school and why these are totally inadequate. What you're going to see from Obama is, of course, the other school, the Malthusian, Keynesian, Green school. This, of course, is tragic. Malthus was a parson. He was part of the state church of Great Britain, that is to say the Anglican Church. So he lived on what they called prebends, that is to say payments from the Church of England to parsons, right, livings as they called them. You see this in these interesting British novels of the 19th century, people like Thackeray and so forth. I read about prebendaries, guys who have public livings. Imagine this. He's an Episcopal minister, gets paid by, in effect, the government or something like that. And his basic argument is this. He says, hey, you capitalists, you guys always have crises of overproduction. You produce too much. And what you need to make sure that you don't have a glut of unsaleable products and commodities on the market is to have a lot of people like me. This is what Malthus says. He says, you need to have parasitical religious characters like me who will get money for doing nothing and can buy up all of this excess production and sustain demand so that you won't go into crisis and then have a revolution and the guillotine comes out and the enragé, the masses, cut off your head. So this is Malthus's argument. He's basically got two things. One is the idea that the population increases geometrically, that is very fast, right? It goes 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and on with that. And the means of sustenance, the agricultural production, is only arithmetic, so it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and is left far behind. Well, it's ridiculous, because that would mean the world has been overpopulated all these many, many years, at least since the transition from the Old Stone Age to the New Stone Age, about 10,000 BC. 10,000 BC would mean the world was already overpopulated then, according to Malthus. In other words, what he's talking about is a situation that simply is not true. In real economic history, it's often the production that increases geometrically and the population over a longer period increases more arithmetically. Now, where did Malthus get this nonsense? He got it from a Venetian kook. If you look on the internet, you'll find essays by me from 10, 15 years ago about Gian Maria Ortes, O-R-T-E-S. Gian Maria, G-I-A-M-M-A-R-I-A. Gian Maria Ortes was a Venetian kook from the 1780s, 1790s, who is the guy who invented the notion of carrying capacity. He said, the technical means of mankind are fixed, immutable, they cannot be improved on, and therefore 3.5 billion people is the most you can ever have. Well, too bad for Gian Maria, we've almost doubled that right now. So Ortez says there is no such thing as technology. There is no way to increase the productivity of labor. There is no way to increase production. And therefore, this is the limit. And the only way, he says, the only way one country gets wealthy is by taking it away from somebody else. So Ortez is the originator of what is known as the zero-sum game, that somebody's benefit is somebody else's loss. That's Jaramillo Ortez. So the carrying capacity myth and the myth of the zero-sum game as applied to world economy is Ortez. And he, of course, is an effluvium coming out of the decaying corpse of Venice in the very last decades of the existence of the Venetians before Napoleon Bonaparte came in and finished them off in 1797. Malthus is simply a plagiarist who copies everything from Ortez. Malthus is basically somebody in the orbit of the British East India Company and their infamous Haileybury School. Now, when you look at Keynes, you can see it's the same idea. Remember, the side of Malthus we need is the anti-technology side, the pessimism about using technology to improve the human condition. Keynes comes along and says that he's a Malthusian. And what he says is basically the same thing. Instead of having a state church with parsons and reverends like Malthus who get paid to do basically nothing and who consume lots and lots of products, what Keynes says is, let's pay workers to dig a ditch and then to fill it back in. If you look at the Keynesian pump priming theory in Keynes's essays and the general theory by Keynes, Keynes says that it's important that the pump priming not produce anything of value. In other words, he says, don't build a new rail line from London to Manchester. Don't build something new, modern technology or increased productivity or better infrastructure. It's better to pay people to do something which is basically useless. And that way you put buying power into the system. Now, if you look at the Barkey stimulus plan argument, which is shared by the Republicans too, to some degree, they all say, putting money into circulation, in other words, getting the economy going by spending money, is going to produce an economic recovery. What they're always talking about is more money going around in the fixed mode. And essentially, this is Malthusian and it's Keynesian. Some people say that the New Deal is based on Keynes. No, wrong, completely wrong. If you look at the Works Progress Administration, the Public Works Administration, what is done there is to build things that are useful, to build water systems, to build bridges, to build roads, to build city halls, to build libraries, to build schools. Go to rural America, half the public buildings are still left over from the Works Progress Administration of the 1930s. So beware of Malthusianism and the green boys, but then beware of monetarism too. And we'll get to the monetarists and the related characters next time.